First of all, I'm honored to be here and be given a chance to speak. Can you hear me? I'll raise it up like this. Okay. Good morning. Some topics defy words. For those topics, we turn to the arts. To present today's topic, I want to play for you the prelude in E-flat major from the fourth cello suite of Johann Sebastian Bach. I should tell you this is a strange piece of music. It was probably originally for organ because you need two hands and two feet to handle all of the voices at once. I first played this piece of music when I was 18. The piece was beyond me then, but I didn't know it. I was going off to college, and I wanted to show off. Other 18-year-old boys would show off by bench pressing 180 pounds, or slam dunking a basketball. I played Bach. So I started playing. But somewhere halfway through the piece, I lost the sense of it, and I wandered through the complex chord progressions with bumpy intonation. When I finally returned to E-flat major at the end of the piece, it seemed off somehow. It seemed like I'd ended in the wrong key. They clapped anyway, but it took the next player in the recital to erase the dissonant aftertaste. So I made a career in science, but I never quit playing Bach. In fact, whenever I run into a seemingly impossible conundrum in the lab, I meditate on Bach. For example, last week, true story, a student in my lab was stuck with a scientific contradiction that neither of us could solve. So I told her, just wait a minute, I have to meditate on a Bach fugue. The interweaving fugal counterpoint traveled in different directions, riffing at cross purposes, notes fighting each other for attention, both melody lines wanting to define their own tonality. But then again, they followed a common bass line. Aha, I said, I know the solution to your problem, I said. And I told her what the two contradicting experiments had in common that tied them together. She knew what to do. Problem solved. In the end, all of those seemingly unresolvable dissonances of science can be resolved eventually if you just pay attention to all the notes. And that's what I wish to explore with you. Is problem solving in science like resolving dissonance in music? If problem solving in science or social science, or political science, is like finding the notes that reconcile, finding the chords that bridge melodies, finding the underlying beat that ties it all together. If life is like one big medley, then whenever things are going wrong, whenever dissonance and discord rule the day, then the way to resolve the dissonance is to listen to all the notes. So let's do some critical listening, starting from easy dissonance and then going to increasingly hard dissonance, and let's see what your brain does with this. Okay, here's some very easy dissonance. I set the tonality. I step away from the tonality. I step back to the tonality. Easy? Yes. Interesting? No. Let's try a harder dissonance. Let's see if I remember this.
Thank you.
I set the tonality. I step away from the tonality. I step farther away. I turn the tonality corner. I look around. I come full circle. Ah, it feels good to be back. Solving a moderately hard dissonance feels good, like solving a moderately hard problem. Now let's try an even harder dissonance. What was that? It didn't resolve. It was incomplete. The tonality was never set, and it left us with a dissonant aftertaste. We may have wished that we had never heard it. I didn't resolve it. Instead, I stopped playing. In science, or social science, or political science, some problems are so hard you can't resolve them to save your life. Most of us avoid these problems. We choose not to hear them. We shut them out. If we know we can't solve the problem, we simply don't try because we know we will be left with a dissonant aftertaste. And that's fine. You can leave a problem unresolved if you don't actually need to solve the problem in order to save your life. But what if we do need to solve the problem? What if you do need to solve the problem to save your life? At this point, I have to tell you, sadly, my life is in danger. I have known this for many years now, and I spend most of my waking hours trying to figure out a way to survive. Not only is my life in danger, your life is in danger too. Everyone's life is in danger. Every human on this planet, in fact, the human species itself is in danger of extinction, sometime in the next century or so, and many other species are also in danger. Only the lowest life forms are safe. The bacteria, the protists, plants are safe, and cockroaches. The danger I speak of, the impossible sadness of the human condition, is the seemingly unresolvable dissonance of human overpopulation. Most of you know what I'm talking about and may be fighting the urge to tune it out as it triggers a dissonant aftertaste, but let me go forward with this. Let me be perfectly clear as to why I think it is life-threatening, even civilization-threatening. First, the math. The problem is populations grow exponentially until they reach a limit. That is, they grow by doubling. That means they grow ever faster. That's not a surprise. Exponential growth is the natural way of living things. If you've ever seen bean dip go bad, you know what I'm talking about. But now it's us. We're doubling. The global human population reached 1 billion in 1802. In 1927, it reached 2 billion, a doubling time of 125 years. 3 billion was reached in 1961, 4 billion in 1974, 5 billion in 1986, 6 billion in 1999, and 7 billion in 2011, a doubling time of about 45 years. Not only are we doubling, we're doubling faster. Practically nobody believes we can double again. The total food resources required for 7 billion people amounts to well over half the maximum total world capacity for food production. And that capacity is itself decreasing with time. Commercial fish stocks in the world's oceans have decreased over 90% over the last 50 years. All of the world's commercial fisheries are projected to be economically unsustainable by the year 2045. This includes farm fish, because to feed farm fish, you need 5 pounds of wild-caught fish to make 1 pound of farm-raised fish. On land, only 1/32nd of the Earth's surface is suitable for growing food, and nearly 100% of that land is already farmed. In the U.S., we are losing 1 million acres of good farmland every year. More than 75% of the nation's fruit, vegetable, and dairy products are produced on urban edge farms that are threatened by sprawling development. And that's not to mention the limits on waste production. We are putting carbon into the atmosphere at well beyond the rate that can be assimilated by plants, and that carbon is warming the earth. And global warming will have unknown effects on food production, probably negative. Rice flours are not pollinated if nighttime temperatures do not fall below 80 degrees Fahrenheit. And alas, rice provides more than 1/5 of the world's caloric intake. Climate change will make some areas too dry and other areas too wet for efficient cultivation. It looks bleak. It looks like we have less than 45 years to live. But let's not assume that. Let's look carefully. Let's listen. Let's look carefully at how things could play out. How bad could it be? Well, on the one hand, we could just stick our collective head in the sand and go about our reproductive business as usual, and then we would grow and grow and grow until what? For this topic, we turn to music. Turn-of-the-century French composer Maurice Ravel once experimented with writing a symphonic work that only increased in volume, never decreased. He started the piece very quietly with a soft snare drum and a clarinet, like a small band of hunter-gatherers migrating out of Africa. Then he added more instruments, bringing the volume up gradually, like the slow growth and spread of the human population through the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages. Then the fullness of the strings comes in, like the birth of the industrial era. And the piece becomes lush and rich, like the good times of exponential growth. The brass comes in, the cymbals crash, and the orchestra wails and roars. The sound gets frantic and strained, like the inner city of a booming metropolis that is packed to the limit of human density. At this point, Ravel discovers that the orchestra cannot, in fact, play infinitely loud. And after reaching a deafening crescendo, the music collapses in a heap. The last note is the loudest. Don't clap for that ending. That ending represents the end of humanity, the end of life as we know it. Ravel's Bolero teaches us that there are limits. The human population cannot, in fact, grow infinitely large. It will reach a limit. Growth will end. But will it end that way? Will we end that way? Will we grow and grow until there's nowhere left to grow? Will we eat the last stunted baby tuna fish in the ocean? Eat the last grain of rice? Pollute the earth like there's no tomorrow and go out with a bang, obstinately playing the same melody, never changing our tune, never adapting, ignoring the signs of change, even as refugees arrive from drought-stricken Texas or flooded Bangladesh? Even as China buys up South America for rice, even as wars flare in previously peaceful places like Egypt, even as starvation carries us to the very edge of sanity, if we do not stop growth, it will end that way, and end can come very quickly. There is an old Spanish proverb that says, civilization and anarchy are only 7 meals apart. With resources stretched to the limit, civilization, becoming uncivil, will pop like a balloon, which once punctured, does not stop popping, but deflates completely? Question mark. No. If you ask me, no, I don't think so. I do not think it will end that way. I think the tune of the human condition from here on out will not be Ravel's Bolero, but Bach's Fourth Cello Suite in E-flat major. We will lose our way temporarily. Things might get a little scary, and it may sound lawlessly atonal for a bit, but we will adapt. We will modulate. We will change our tune, and we will eventually find our way back to the tonality we started in. The balloon representing our overextended resources will shrink instead of popping. And if the balloon gets punctured by anarchy and terrorism, it will be an isolated puncture and will not spread across the globe, because our resources will not be overextended and we will have something in reserve when the supply lines break down. And we will do this by listening. By listening to the impossible sadness of the human condition, we will hear that it is not so sad after all, and not so impossible. There is, in fact, a solution. It is an easy one, and it is a peaceful one. There are many people who are listening to this sad tune, and they see the solution, and they're out there trying to get our attention, but they're still like a small voice in the wilderness. They are saying, stop population growth. They are saying, if you increase the number of people on the planet, you increase the root causes of suffering and unrest. They are the Population Media Center, the Global Population Speak Out. They are David Suzuki and Richard Attenborough. They are Elizabeth McCullough, who made the movie Mother, Caring for 7 Billion, which I have shown here and would gladly lend to anybody who will watch. The peaceful solution to overpopulation, they who know say, is 1, the empowerment of women, and 2, adequate health care for all children. So no, war is not the answer. Global epidemic is not the answer. Starvation is certainly not a good solution. This is not some feel-good message tuned to the sensitivities of Unitarian Universalists. This is the conclusion of experts, the visionaries, and the wise. This is the way that has been tested in the field: the empowerment of women and better health care for children. The empowerment of women worldwide means putting family size decisions where they belong, with the mother, not with the father, whose motivations may be colored by competition or ideology, and not with governments and churches whose cultural practices may not be adapted to the time. Men, governments, and oppressive religions must step aside. If we do this, the global birth rate will drop. Currently, roughly 38% of all pregnancies worldwide are unplanned or unwanted. Simply eliminating this 38% would immediately stop population growth. In addition, we know that unwanted children are at greater risk of low birth weight, at greater risk of being abused, and are more likely not to receive sufficient resources for healthy development. Most, if not all, unplanned pregnancies could be prevented by safe, easy, effective contraception and by the concomitant education of young women. Contraceptive technologies are good, but they can improve, they can be made cheaper, and women must be empowered to take advantage of these technologies. Improving the health of children is also critical to stop population growth, because mothers whose children are healthy choose to have fewer children. Recent improvements in child health have contributed to a decrease in family size in every country in sub-Saharan Africa except Nigeria and Chad. Most of these countries now maintain a low 2.6 children per mother fertility rate. Rwanda's fertility declined an amazing 25% between 2005 and 2010. But in Nigeria, 40% cite religious beliefs as the main reason for the non-use of family planning, while in Chad, women still cite an ideal family size of 9 children, and only 45% of married women have contraceptive knowledge. So these are the challenges. So let's face the facts. Population growth must end, and there are only two ways for this to happen. Either the birth rate decreases or the death rate increases. No one is proposing the latter. The global population is currently growing at its fastest rate ever, 1 billion new people every 12 years. But there are signs that this is turning around. Eastern Europe, Japan, and many regions in China are already shrinking in population. In the US, the non-immigrant white population went down for the first time in history this year. And women are becoming empowered throughout the world, led by incumbent female heads of state in 15 countries, including Switzerland, Brazil, Argentina, Liberia, South Korea, and Australia, and even in Texas. A very restrictive new abortion law was temporarily stopped by a filibuster carried out by the courageous state senator Wendy Davis and a crowd of, quote, loud, unruly protesters. The key to addressing the largest of all dissonance is to stay loud and unruly, to keep bringing it up, and not to stop talking about it until after that dissonance aftertaste is resolved and the threat of a crash is averted. If you're wondering why you should talk about such an unpleasant subject as global population, just remember these three reasons. One, because overpopulation is the root cause of starvation, war, and injustice. Two, because no problem is ever solved by not talking about it. And three, because resolving the greatest problem of our time will bring the greatest happiness. So now, to help you engage with dissonance, I will play the Prelude in E-flat major by Johann Sebastian Bach.
another change of venue here, not venue, but position. If you will, please join in singing hymn number 1010. We give thanks in your teal hymnal, and you can stand if you can. If you'll please be seated. The closing words that Chris has chosen are from A. Powell Davies. There is no God in the sky. God is in the heart that loves the sky's blueness. It is not the supernatural that is spiritual. The supernatural is a flight from the spiritual, a flight into something projected as material, a thing of childish imagery. If we are to be equal to the times we live in and to the greater problems the future will bring, we must outgrow our childishness. We cannot afford to trust the unreal, to exchange the courage of struggle for the cowardice of begging for miracles. And if you'll join me in the chalice reading, the unison extinguishing of the chalice. I'm going to suggest that we sit for the postlude, because who wants to be wandering around and listen to Chris? We just sit. We extinguish this flame, but not the light. I don't know where he found.
Thank you.